Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Some say love, it is a river that drowns the tender reed.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Bette Midler is with us now. Recalling her blue sky world of before the AIDS epidemic, she has just released her 30-plus-year-old book about her first world tour called A View from Abroad. Let's look back and look forward and look across to the Palisades now for a current piece of her activism with the divine Miss M. Bette, such an honor. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much.
You set the scene in the new introduction to the book saying by 1980, the 60s were finally over. The cloud of HIV/AIDS was about to descend on the blue sky world I was living in. Looking back, how would you describe that blue sky world of 1980?
Well, it was a frivolous time, you know. It seemed like it was a very creative time. There were a lot of wonderful things happening in art, in culture, in pop culture, in the huge amount of nightlife. It was just kind of reckless. A lot of reckless behavior. There was nothing dark on the horizon. That's what it felt like at the time.
And you were an icon for gay men in the 1970s. What do you think it was about your act that drew that crowd?
Well, you know what? I've been thinking about this, and I think I have a clue. First of all, the fact that what I did was so over the top.
Yeah.
It was it was extreme, but it was also everything. It had everything in it. It had music. It had chatter. It had jokes. You would laugh. You would cry. You know, it had a great deal of emotionalism. It was hyper emotional. So I think that's how I think that's what drew them to me, and also the fact that I was that my name got around because I was working at the Continental Baths at the time. But I also think that when I stepped out into the wide world and was playing in nightclubs and small arenas and theaters, I think the fact that that entire community came together, and I don't think they had ever seen all of themselves in a room together. I think that really sort of knocked them out. I think they didn't realize there were that many of them.
It was after Stonewall, but it was before the contemporary height of the movement, which in a way formed around a response to the AIDS epidemic.
Well, yes and no. There was a lot going on between the Stonewall riots and the AIDS crisis. There was a lot going on. It wasn't as riotous as the AIDS crisis finally became, but there was a huge amount going on. There
absolutely.
Were lots of parades, lots of meetings, I remember being invited to, I could have gone, you know, all day, every day to this committee or that.
Uh-huh.
I went occasionally. I didn't go all that much because I was on another path, but it was curious to watch. The reason I say this is because I was interviewed the other day by a woman in Texas who said I was a when I went to your concert in the 70s, this is like the early 70s, I was a married straight woman, and she said, and when I got to your concert, there were so many gay people, and I didn't know there were that many gay people in the world. I thought I was the only one. And I said, really? She said she came out 3 years later, and she blamed it on me.
You broke up that marriage.
I was like, oh, my gosh. I didn't know what to say.
You mentioned
I'm sorry. So the idea of that there was a community that they didn't know existed was, I think, something that had never occurred to me. I just heard about it last week.
And you mentioned the Continental Baths. For young people today who didn't come of age around that, I think it's almost inconceivable today. What feelings or images remain with you about that?
Well, but not what anyone thought about it. It was actually pretty wholesome, to tell you the truth. I wasn't interested really in what was going on behind the closed doors. I was really interested in getting up on the stage and honing my craft, which is what I did. And I had very long hair at the time, and my clothes were very, very low cut, and I was, you know, I wasn't wearing a brassiere, and I was wearing a lot of makeup, and, you know, really camping it up. And my sense of it was a lot of fun. It was a very exciting for me because people really appreciated what I did. So for me, it was a completely different experience. I was at the center of it, and I don't think it will ever be duplicated.
Bette Midler with us on WNYC, talking about the re-release of her book from the early 80s about her first world tour called A View from Abroad. And we can take some phone calls for Bette Midler about then or now or tomorrow, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post a question to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Bette, you recall in the book that your goal was to make the book funny, but a lot of bad things as well as good things happened on the tour. Fist fights, drugs, accidents, arrests, screaming matches, fires, all your words. How did that tour make your 35-year-old self grow up?
Well, I realized, you know, the expression herding cats was probably created on that tour. How did it make my 35-year-old self feel? Well, I really wanted to get out from under. That was the first, you know, save yourself was probably my first instinct. But it was also pretty fascinating because it was there was so much acting out, and there was really very little you could do about it. I tended to, you know, to retreat. And I don't think that was really the healthiest thing to do. I, you know, subsequent tours, you would learn to sort of have meetings and kind of get a lot of things out in the open. In those days, we didn't do that. You know, people went their separate ways and were or were not what they were.
Today, you'd fire people.
Yeah, you would fire. You would fire. No, you don't fire. You discuss.
Uh-huh.
You know, you sort of discuss the whole group. You'll have like group therapy together, or you'll have a very strong road manager you'll have the enforcer.
And
in those days, you know, that kind of traveling for us was brand new. So we didn't really, you know, we were flying by the seat of our pants. It was it's a different world now.
One funny moment in the book is when you write, my choreographer had, since I last worked with her, turned in her tutus and gotten into punk. This time out, number after number emerged dripping with violence and hostility. Is that a true story?
That's totally true. Tony Basil, the crazy great Tony Basil, oh, Mickey, you're so fine, who is still one of my best friends.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, she had decided she was into punk. Her picture is in the photo. Her photo is in the book. And one of the great moments of my life with Tony was when we made a movie together. Right after that tour, we made Divine Madness together, and she didn't think the costumes were punk enough, and she took a scissors to them just right before we were going to go on. So when the girls came to put their clothes on, they had nothing left. They were wearing, you know, two snaps and a set of buttons. It was hilarious, and of course the actual costumer was beside himself with rage. I mean,
huh.
I have to tell you, show business is a laugh a minute. It's also a tear a minute, you know. It can be heartbreaking and heartwarming and hilarious all at the same time.
But the punk scene with all that hostility and your gay bath scene dripping with all that love and lust were going on at the exact same time in Lower Manhattan, one more in the East Village, the other more in the West Village. Looking back, did something connect the two as 1970s expressions, or were they just both there?
I think it was all in the air. It was all in the air, and people just couldn't help but pick up on it. And don't forget, there was a lot going on in the drug world, and there was disco, which had taken over from, you know, sort of earnest music, earnest rock and roll,
right,
and earnest, very, very masculine rock and roll. And I think there was a major backlash at the end. In the 80s, I think everyone says disco is dead, January 1st, 1980, and that was the end of that. And the AIDS crisis started just around the same time. So there was a lot of bad behavior in the 70s, you know, huge amounts of drug ingestion and all that stuff, and bad, you know, hopping in and out of beds. And I guess the chickens came home to roost in a way. They came home to roost in the 80s. So I think it was in the ether. It was the it was the end of that generation's set of rebellions. And I was a kind of a bystander and a chronicler in a way. You know, I was a reflection. I wasn't really, I wasn't at the heart of it. I was just reflecting it.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. Brian Lehrer on New York and New Jersey Public Radio with Bette Midler on the occasion of the re-release of her early 80s book, A View from Abroad, about her first world tour. Lisa on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC with Bette Midler. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was calling because in the late 70s, early 80s, my husband, who's since died, was diagnosed with AIDS, and I became HIV positive and been doing super well now. But in the late 70s, there were meetings that we went to where my husband was welcomed with open arms. Everybody's great, super sympathetic. He, you know, was really sick, and it was, you know, he got a warm welcome. And because I was a woman and there weren't that many women, there weren't that many of us out there, and we definitely weren't going to meetings, there wasn't a huge welcome in, there wasn't a lot of support for us. And I often thought of Bette Midler because, Bette Midler, you have always been out there for everyone, not just gay men, but for HIV positive women in a kind of a cheerful, wonderful, great attitude way. And I always kind of thought to myself, well, if she can be out there and do it and be who she is, I can too. So you have served as an inspiration to me. And Lisa isn't my real name. I'm not using it because I have children who are grown. But I don't know. I just wanted to say how wonderful you are and how inspiring and how open and generous and non-judgmental. How wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That's really kind.
Thank you very much, Lisa. We have a lot of calls like that we could take. Let's take at least one more. King in Glen Rock. You're on WNYC. Hello, King.
Hey, good morning. Thanks. I want to speak to in the time in the late 70s before technology, and that as a gay man in Louisiana, Bette Midler did reflect something that was extraordinary, and it wasn't just the art and culture. There was also an element of an outsider making it in a way that wasn't mainstream. I mean, Bette was diminutive. Jewish woman seemed to have all this stuff against her, and she was bigger than life. And I remember seeing photos of her and having inspiration about myself without even understanding why. And so I respect her courage and what must have been a struggle, as all performers have, but seems to me probably more so for people who don't fit some stereotype of either talent or what we want to perceive as beauty.
King, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, King.
Does that ring true with you about the struggle? And
I, to tell you the truth, I was so lucky. I was so lucky. I think that my will must have been, gigantic, because I just kept putting one foot in front of the other and not taking no for an answer. But I, in a way, actually what he says is correct. You know, I was an outsider. I was different. I did look different. I sounded different. What I was doing was different. Although in the continuum, in the river of what performers do, I was really doing something that had been done, for eons and eons before me. I was I was the fool. I was telling jokes. I was a tumbler. I was making fun. I was sending things up. I was, and I was doing it all. I wasn't doing just one thing. You know, I wasn't just singing or just dancing or just telling jokes. I was doing all of it at the same time. So, yes, I was an outsider. And although he says there was a struggle, there was a struggle, and the struggle continues, because you still say, well, didn't I get that part? And you realize, well, you just don't fit that. You don't fit that bill. You don't fit that role.
And he mentioned you being Jewish. You grew up as a Jew in Hawaii, didn't you?
Yes.
Where in Hawaii, and how small a minority?
Where in Hawaii? Well, I grew up in a town called Iaea, a small town called Iaea, which is still there. And my parents moved to that town in the early 50s, like 51 or 52. And I was I went to second grade there. I started second grade there, and I didn't really go. It was an all Asian school. There were Hawaiian. Well, I shouldn't say all Asian. It was Polynesian, mostly Polynesians and Asians in the school. We were the only white family in the school for years. And then some white people came, and it was, oh, look, there's white people. But it was, you know, my sisters were bullied. My older sister was bullied terribly. My middle sister, she did pretty well. She assimilated. But I was like, I was an introvert, you know. I was a reader and a bookworm. I kind of stayed a lot. I stayed to myself. I was very shy.
And Jewish identified?
I went for, huh?
Jewish
what?
Identified?
No, absolutely not. No such thing. Not on the radar. Jew, they didn't even know from that. What they did know is that you were white, and if you were mm-hmm. white, you were like, it was anathema. They didn't want you near them. They wouldn't speak to you. I went from the time I was in second grade until the time I was in ninth grade with no one ever saying good morning to me or saying hello.
For being white.
Yeah.
In America.
No, well, in Hawaii, it wasn't really America. It was, you know what, to tell you the truth, it was a territory at the time.
Right.
And I, you know
what? Oh, right. It wasn't even a state. You were born
in
1945?
I was. It was a territory.
So you were like the very first baby boomer.
I was. Don't tell.
Was your father in World War II?
My father came to Hawaii in 1933. He was in the army in 1933 in Waianae on the other side of the island. And he came back to New Jersey, married my mother, and brought her over there in 1937, and then they stayed through the war. So no, he wasn't in the war. He worked for the Navy that whole time, and worked for the Navy until he retired. So
the time you were 20, you were on Broadway in Fiddler on the Roof.
I think I was maybe 24, okay. 23, 24, yeah.
How did you develop your kinds of showbiz sensibilities in Polynesian Hawaii as a white minority of one?
I watched. I had my eyes open. I watched what was on the movies, in the movies. And, of course, I daydreamed about that. We didn't go very often, but my mother only let me go to musicals because she was not a horror person or a sci-fi person. She only liked musicals, and she liked happy things. So we were... It was all happy. We would go to the Esther Williams, or we would see Catherine Greyson or something like that. And... It was an enchanting world, you know. It was three-stripe Technicolor, although I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know what to call it, but I knew the colors were as intense as they were if you went outside in Hawaii. It was gorgeous. So I fell in love with those sets and costumes and the attitudes and sounds, and I just sort of carried on from there. And when I was a little girl, I worked in the library with this with a girlfriend of mine. I was in the seventh grade, and the librarian sent me and my friend to a show on the other side of the island. My very first show, the first show I'd ever seen, the first real show I'd ever seen, and I think it was Carousel. And we were like in the seventh grade. We had to take a bus. Oh my God, we took a bus all the way. It must have been 20 miles, which was unheard of. And we got to the theater, and we sat down, and the curtain went up, and I remember my heart beating really fast, and the orchestra was playing, the little teeny-weeny orchestra was playing, and when the curtain went up, there were the most beautiful things, the most beautiful people I'd ever seen in my life. They were all pink, and their hair was curly, and they were wearing skimpy clothes and pink tights and high heels, and it was just like a sight that, it was a vision. It was like something, it was like a way into heaven.
A pilgrimage to Carousel is what got you.
I never got over it.
Bette Midler with us for a few more minutes here on WNYC on the occasion of the re-release of her early 80s book,
A
View from Abroad.
Oh,
I want to talk about your appearance tonight at Barnes & Noble in a minute on Union Square, but one reason you are beloved by many New Yorkers is your work with parks and urban beautification and restoration.
Yeah.
How'd you first get into that?
Well, you know, I've always been heavily, very, very moved and very, very happy in the natural world. I love nature, in spite of what it did to me. I have a sense of order that I feel nature gives to you. I'm not saying this correctly. Let me backtrack and say I love nature and I love being in nature. And because I was brought up in probably the most beautiful spot in the whole world, the most benign spot in the whole world. We don't have any poisonous animals there. I've always felt very happy and very safe in nature. And when I came to the continental United States and I saw the carelessness with which people treated the natural environment, it really distressed me because it was a symptom of something that I couldn't really understand. That wasn't the way I had been brought up. You know, I was practically brought up in the Japanese way, which is to honor nature and that, you know, honor nature, honor your ancestors, and there's a spirit in every tree. So it made a big impression on me, and I really wanted to change it. And I know it was very, tilting at windmills to pick up a piece of garbage one piece at a time. But really, literally, that's what I set out to do. And I couldn't help myself. And I started doing it when I was very young, and it got more and more, it took hold of me in a bigger way when I came back to New York in 1995. The streets were so dirty, and the parks, some of the parks were really unlivable, uninhabitable. I mean, people literally couldn't go into them. So I started an organization called New York Restoration Project, and we started in upper northern Manhattan in Fort Tryon Park and Fort Washington Parks, and those are really, really beautiful parks, the jewels in our crown, and in fact. And we've built parks. We built the Swindler Cove on the other side of the island up by Harlem River. We built the first boathouse in 100 years on the Harlem River. We have rowing programs going out of that. And it's been a thrill. Now we're in all five boroughs. We have community gardens. We bought our community gardens just at the time when urban agriculture was taking hold of the public imagination. And that has been a real thrill to see that happen. To see people say, well, gee, we really don't have any good food here. Let's have a farmer's market or let's grow our own. It's been a thrill to watch, just a thrill.
I see you've spoken up and written a letter to LG in opposition to the height of their proposed office tower that would rise above the pristine cliffs of the Palisades across the Hudson from Fort Tryon Park. Yes. Can you talk about that issue?
Yes, I can. The Rockefeller family deeded the Cloisters Museum and Fort Tryon Park, and bought the Palisades across from the Cloisters, so that the view would be unspoiled. It was all a package, and it was a family package, and it was given to the state of New York, and to the city of New York, and to the state of New York, and the state of New Jersey. And it was kind of an unwritten agreement. The Palisades part was an unwritten agreement, and all the towns around the Palisades have sort of held on to that code. Since it was given in the late 30s. And it's very, very beautiful. Now, LG, which is not an American company, it's a Korean electronics company, wants to build a gigantic tower sticking right up out of the Palisades Park, which will destroy that view and will probably encourage other corporations to do the same, so that the intent of the family will be destroyed. And I think it'll really ruin the impact of what that area had forever. And so it's distressing. It's really, really distressing. I know that change is inevitable, but certain kinds of change are not inevitable. And I think when people have what are considered national treasures or landmarks or historic landmarks or things that are really given to the entire public, not to just a conglomerate or to a corporation, they should cherish them, and they should take care. They should cherish them, and they should see that generations to come are allowed to enjoy them the way we have, the way they were promised to us.
Nicely said.
I really do feel. I feel that it's incumbent upon us to save what belongs to future generations.
And you have at least four past New Jersey governors from both parties on your side. You know, Byrne, Florio, Kane, and Whitman have all weighed in against the LG eyesore plan. Do you have a minute for one more phone call?
Sure.
Dale in Jersey City, because I think he remembers the original release of this book. Dale? Dale, please be there. I think you have a good story for Bette Midler. Dale in Jersey City? Going once? Aw, all right.
Aww.
Well, I think he had a bookstore in Jersey City in 1980, and you did a book signing, and there was a huge crowd. You remember that?
I went all over the country with my book. I sometimes say, you know, and I sold and signed every book myself. I really do believe that. Because I sold, we had these fabulous book signings where, you know, we would, you know, put balloon. We had a little set, and we would take questions, and we would sing a little, and it was a lot of fun. People lined up, and I signed all those books. It was fun.
Wait, here he is, Dale. Where was that book signing?
That was at B. Dalton Bookseller at 666 Fifth Avenue and 53rd, across from MoMA. And Miss Midler was terrific. She came in with this wonderful typewriter hat and delighted hundreds who stood in line around the block over to MoMA for hours signing the book.
There you go.
That was one of my finest hours. That typewriter hat was genius, I have to say.
And I see you're doing a book appearance at 7 o'clock tonight at the Union Square Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
And you told the Daily News you never buy a book online that you can buy in a bookstore. You think we're losing something culturally important?
No question about it. I am a big, big supporter of all bookstores everywhere. I go into them. They are my public spaces of choice. I love them. I sit around for hours. I dip into, you know, hundreds of books at a time, and I love them. I mean, I have my corner bookstore up here on Madison and 94th, which I go to all the time. There's Crawford and Doyle. You know what? I'll tell you something. A town without bookstore is a town without culture. And you know what? Books themselves, print, the covers, the credits, the thank yous, the dedications, the all of it. I mean, I just love them so much. I do have my Kindle, but if I'm traveling, I'll put a book on a Kindle. But I won't just buy it to read it on a Kindle. I prefer to have the book, you know, on my belly in bed. I just prefer it.
Last question. How did you feel singing Wind Beneath My Wings at the Oscars for the In Memoriam segment? You know, you had Julia Roberts and half of America crying.
Oh.
Is it emotional for you as a performer, or do you have a different, just professional do this relationship to it?
Well, you know, that's very bright of you. Professional do this, it has to come first, because you can't crack. You know, you can't choke. It's imperative that you not choke. So you do have to keep your emotions in check. And so it's a delicate balance. I was very nervous about the first week after I had been asked, and then I had to put all that nervousness aside and really concentrate on what I had to do. So it was, you know, it was a struggle. And in the end, I said, "Oh, I feel like I just won the Olympics." I think they cut me off. I didn't see it. I feel like I just won the Olympics, because it really was like training and getting ready for the big event, and then, you know, having it go very well and having the crowd like it. It was very, very gratifying, and I was really thrilled for the opportunity.
Bette Midler's book, A View from Abroad, from the early 80s, just re-released. Book signing tonight at 7 at Barnes & Noble Union Square. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. Talk to you soon. Bye.
The man who swears he's not to blame, say to him, you know that broken, lonely woman, you tell you no, he don't.